Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's time to take a look at your taxes. Have you been working on your taxes? Have you handed them off to someone else to do? Tell you what, if you have questions, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals probably has the answer. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. As we talk with Mary, and she's been with us many times, so you know how good she is at this, I hope you'll join in with your own questions about filing your taxes. You can give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us. Mary, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay, we got you. Good. I tell you what, last month we were talking about some of the changes, the new changes in the tax situation, and I thought it'd be worth it to maybe continue that discussion. What about senior deductions for the state and federal? Are they different than they were in the past?
They exist now.
Ah.
The senior deduction for anyone who is age 65 or older exists. There is an income limit. Your modified adjusted gross income as a single person has to be $75,000 or less. As a married couple, it's $150,000 or less. And modified adjusted gross income for this purpose generally is your adjusted gross income. That's kind of like all of your income.
Yeah.
The modification is if you have some foreign earned income or some foreign excluded income, that has to be added back. So that doesn't involve a lot of people. That deduction gives you up to $6,000 for each person that is meets those conditions. As your income goes above the 75 and above the 150, that deduction scales down at the rate of, I believe, 30%. So you're still able to get, I think it's 6%, so back up with that one. But you're still able to, you won't lose it all just because you have a dollar over those limits. The state takes a little different approach. The state already excludes Social Security. And the $65 or 65-year exemption was kind of a way of getting no tax on Social Security, which didn't work out with the way the bill was passed. So that's kind of a replacement. The state of Wisconsin doesn't tax Social Security, so they took a little different approach, and they have a retirement deduction. And the retirement deduction is $24,000 if you're a single person, $48,000 if you're a married couple. And you have to have retirement income, obviously, and that's IRAs or pension plans that you can use to offset, or this deduction offsets that. The difference is that you have to be age 67 before you qualify for the Wisconsin side, and there's a trade-off. If you take the Wisconsin deduction, you give up your right to credits. And for normal people, there's the rent and property tax credit that we see most often, maybe the itemized deduction credit. But you have to look at the situation and see which place is better.
Yeah. I see the IRS is not issuing paper checks anymore.
No, it's a way to cut down on costs. So if you are used to getting and putting your hands on that nice IRS check, you won't be able to do that.
Interesting. And what about this whole issue between tips and overtime? I know there's some changes. Are there something in there as well?
Yes. There is a new Form 1A, and the 1A form takes care of four of the major deductions or major changes due to the tax change. And it's overtime, tips, the senior deduction, and a deduction for the interest on your new car loan. So all four are covered in that form. With the tips and overtime, first of all, you have to be paying taxes on your tips to get a deduction for those. And they're qualified tips, so it has to be voluntary tips. You know, not something, sometimes you go in the restaurant and the menu will say for groups of six or more, we automatically tack on a tip.
Yeah.
Those are not considered qualified tips. It's up to the employer to tell the employee what their qualified tips are. And basically, that's kind of a shot in the dark this year because the employers aren't penalized for doing it. But the employer has to have a box seven for the tips that they report to the government to pay FICA on. And for most of us, that's the way we go this year. Next year, IRS will have a separate box on the W-2 for qualified tips.
And maybe anything relating to, I think there was something relating to the child tax credit refunds?
The child tax credit, child tax, EIC, the whole thing, the IRS is not going to issue those refunds until after the 1st of March. They want to make sure that they're legitimate and there is a great deal of fraud or misappropriations of funds in those areas. So the IRS likes to make sure that the W-2s and the earned income records are all there because EIC is based on that. And to make sure that they're not giving away more than they should be, they delay the issuing of those refunds until that point.
Makes sense. Well, we have a number of callers online with questions for you, so let's turn to Rick in Fond du Lac first. Rick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I got kind of a two-part question. I'm going to be going through a divorce, and for last year's taxes, if I cannot find my wife, or she won't sign for the filing joint, how can I file joint, or am I able to? Or if I go ahead and file single, how much more percentage am I going to end up paying?
That's a very good question. First of all, joint filing is an election, so both people have to participate in it. Is the divorce final yet?
It didn't even start yet. So end of last year, we were basically.
So the two of you are still married on the last day of the year, which means you have the opportunity to file jointly. If she won't participate, then you're required to file separate. The catch is that in Wisconsin, it's a community property state, and the government says because it's community property, your income should be split. If she won't give you the income, then you have an alternative to send her half of your income so that she has her numbers to do it. And she is supposed to send you half of her income. And she does have until the extended due date to do that. So if you file with half of your income and don't have hers, you could be doing an amended return if she decides she's going to send it to you sometime before October 15th. If you file just with your own income and married filing separate, which is the way you'd have to file, it's better than doing nothing, but it wouldn't be the exactly correct filing. Have you lived together at all during last year?
all the way up till December.
All the way up till to December. So Wisconsin normally says if, or federal says if you didn't live together at all during the year, you just report your own share of income. But that isn't the case. So if you absolutely can't get her to do it, better to file a return with your income than not to file a return at all.
Do you, in this case, would Rick send some kind of note, explanatory note along with it, or what would?
That is also, that's always, you know, you can always attach a statement, even if you electronically file the return. Keep in mind that married filing separate is the least advantageous way of filing. A lot of times in the lower brackets, it's the same as single as far as the tax rates. But there are things with married filing separate that you cannot do. There is a level for your Social Security, for IRAs that you can't do. You don't claim the child care credit. You can't get EIC. So there are just some things with married separate that are not as advantageous. But if that's the way, if you can't file a joint return, then that's your only alternative.
Yeah. Those are your alternatives. And of course, the other one is to continue to try in a nice way to get your spouse, for now, to turn over the information you need. And you could maybe explain that to her in a letter. Rick, that's what we got for you. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Mellum, tax Robinson, I'm sorry, a tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, her business, Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at 12:30 today, we'll talk with animal behaviorist Patricia McConnell about her debut novel. It's titled A Way to Me. That's at 12:30. Right now, looking at your taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals. And Jim in Madison, I believe, has a question. Let's go there. Jim, hello.
Hey, good morning, Larry. And boy, what perfect timing. I had designated today as the day to finally begin to sort out my income taxes. So I heard this program come up, and I've heard Mary before. She's wonderful. Well, here's my question. It's a basic question, but I bet a lot it would be helpful to a lot of people. I'm newly retired as of December 31st. I'm 70 years old. I did begin collecting Social Security last year in March, so I did receive some Social Security payments. And here's my question. So as I file my income taxes for 2025, obviously I'll get the W-2 form for my work and I'll pay that. But then I never recall having anything withheld from the Social Security amount that I got each month. And I gather that is totally taxable, right? It's income, and so I guess I'll have to include that with the income I received from my work. So, A, do you have some guidance as to how much that would be? I mean, what the tax rate on that? And B, it seems to me, wasn't I taxed on that before, all during my working life? And so I'm now being taxed on it again. I just wanted to get your reaction and advice about how to go through this.
Sure.
Well, first of all, Jim, it's a great question. And, you know, as someone just said to me, ooh, we're paying tax on Social Security. That's not fair. We do pay into the Social Security system. I don't know the stats about how your return on your investment is, but the law says that Social Security may be taxable. If your only retirement is Social Security, you won't pay taxes on it. As you have other income, the Social Security is either 0% taxable or zero of it is included, up to 50% is included, or up to 85%. So worst case scenario, if you take your Social Security benefits, multiply it by 85% and add that to your income, that would give you the worst case scenario with it. And it's going to depend on your tax bracket, how much of that, how much the tax rate on that amount is. So if you're in the 22% tax bracket, when you add the Social Security into it, it's going to be 22% of 85% of it. And again, all of it depends on your particular circumstance, where you fit in that. But the 85% of it is worst case scenario.
Yeah. So that it just gets lumped in with the other income that Jim has, basically.
Correct.
Yeah.
There is a line, a special line on the tax return for Social Security. The IRS has worksheets that you would work through. You know, if you're doing your own tax return, go to the IRS website, type in Social Security, and you will find the worksheet that would help you. It might even be in the instructions to the 1040 for that particular line. Again, it isn't. There is a worksheet, so sometimes it's not as taxable as 85%, but if you want the worst-case version, that would be the way to look at it.
All right. Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. A tax question for Mary, give a call at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Bridget in Madison next. Bridget, hello. Bridget, are you there? I think she's there, but she's not. She may not be hearing us. So we'll go away from Bridget and turn to our emails that we have. John emailed to say he's close to drawing on his pension at 56 years old. John has property and a bank account in Florida. Should John become a Florida resident when he starts drawing? John also wants to know if he and his wife should file together while John is a Florida resident and his wife still works in Wisconsin.
Interesting question.
Yeah.
I call those snowbirds. Florida is an attractive place from an income standpoint, income tax standpoint, because Florida has no state income tax. But one thing I like to remind people of, it takes money to run any government. And if you don't get it from income tax, you have to get it from somewhere. So, yes, you can save on income taxes, but you may pay more in other places. So just keep that in the back of your mind. If you are a Wisconsin resident and you choose to be a Florida resident, you have to do all of the things that changing residency involves. And that means changing your banks, your churches, your doctors, your driver's license. And so, yes, you can become a Florida resident and avoid the state tax on it unless you have property here in Wisconsin. If you own a home jointly with your wife or real estate, any other real estate in Wisconsin, and you are a Florida resident, when that real estate is sold, you're going to pay taxes to Wisconsin. Or if any, to the extent that anything is Wisconsin income, property, business, that type of thing, you don't escape the Wisconsin tax on it. If you move to Wisconsin, move to Florida, you would not be in a community property state. So filing a joint return for federal would mean you could file together for federal, but your wife's Wisconsin income would be as a separate person because you wouldn't be, you would be a Florida resident or a non-resident, so to speak. So yes, you might save money, but you're creating much more complications for you. Sometimes it's worth it, sometimes it's not.
Yeah. something to think about, that's for sure. Kim in Sister Bay, your turn. Hi, Kim.
Sir. Yes, sir. Say, I recently brought my brother out of the farm, and I was solicited by some companies that said that I could have the nutrients in the soil tested, and that there's a clause that says I can depreciate the value of the nutrients. I was wondering if she knew anything about that.
Yes, I've heard of it. I do not know the what it takes to get it valued, but like things like part of things that are added, like a building, that's depreciable. And yes, there is a factor. Land itself is not depreciable. That's why you have to get a value for those nutrients. So there are people that do value that, and I've heard it done. I have not had any experience with it one-on-one, you know, at my clients, that type of thing. But it is a possibility, and I have no idea of the cost of what it would be to value that property. You'd have to check in and see if it, you know, if it's worth the cost.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Could be a big cost or maybe not much if they just take one sample and use one sample. But there's probably a rule on that. You probably have to take several samples, would be my guess, over a range of the fields and kind of go from there. And I have no idea who specifically would, you know, have the credentials in order to do that for you. That's the problem, from my perspective anyway. We have Kim, or Keith, I should say. He says he has a previous year carryover capital loss for both federal and Wisconsin, and no capital gains in 2025. Keith's applying $3,000 of the carryover loss to his 2025 federal ordinary income. This is all entered on federal Schedule D, and the software carries the amounts to Wisconsin Schedule WD. Everything works fine on the federal side. However, while the Schedule Wisconsin D reduces his Wisconsin capital gains carryover amount by $3,000, there's no reduction in his Wisconsin income, and he wonders if that sounds right.
Yes, it is. The reason is Wisconsin's income starts with your AGI from the federal. Your AGI from the federal has already been reduced by that $3,000, so you are getting it. In the old days, before Wisconsin followed state federal law, Wisconsin only allowed a $500 capital loss in a year, and so we had an adjustment of $2,500 on the addition form for that part of it, or an add back to Wisconsin. So you're getting it. It just doesn't show up separately like it used to. Otherwise, you'd be double dipping.
Ah, okay. Purva in Verona, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for hosting this great show, and thanks, Mary. My question essentially is that I was completing graduate studies in Georgia, and as a part of that, I was adjuncting or teaching at various small colleges and also online in different states. So if I added up, it's around four different states that I was doing this. None of the income was, you know, it wasn't very high income, so not a lot of money earned. But last year I got really screwed because of all the different states. So I'm just trying to figure out how to navigate this, or if it's just out of my wheelhouse as a individual to figure out the different states.
Well, that's a very good question, and different is the appropriate word. As every state sees income earned in its state in a different way. For instance, if you come from outside of Wisconsin to teach in Wisconsin, you're performing services here, and if you earn $2,000 or more, you have to file a Wisconsin tax return. some states say if you file a federal return and you have earned income in our state, you have to file it regardless. You're going to have to look at each of the states that you were in and see how they treat non-resident income. There is no consistent rule between all the states.
As you were talking, I was thinking about professional baseball players.
Oh, they're fun.
If they got 3 days in Wisconsin and they're making $50 million a year on a daily basis, I bet those folks spend a lot of money with tax professionals.
It's interesting. Baseball, you have so many games. Football is another one where the half of the football games that are played in other places create income for those states when the football players or the coaches are in those states. So, yes, and the states are very anxious to get their share of that money.
I'm sure they are. Oh, boy. Well, Apoorva, I hope this helps. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Charles in Oshkosh has something. Let's go there. Hi, Charles.
Hi. A person who inherits, say, has a loan to their parent and the parent forgives the loan at death, does that result in debt forgiveness income to the child? Or is that, does the child get a step up in basis? Maybe you can talk about debt forgiveness income and step up in basis at death.
Okay. First of all, if it's a loan that was forgiven at death, you know, in the will, if it's not tied to a piece of property and the debt is forgiven, there isn't going to be any debt forgiveness income. That's, you know, part of the inheritance in that case. If, on the other hand, there is a land contract, for instance, where the child buys from the parent and owes the parent money, and it becomes part of the estate to forgive the remaining part, then on the decedent's, either on the estate, and I always have to look this up, but it is income to either the decedent's estate or the decedent's final return. Logically, it would be the decedent's estate. But they would be treated as if they had collected that money in the forgiveness. So in that way, someone, not the person receiving it, but the person who is forgiving it, is the one who is going to have the income. Generally, I believe it's going to be the 1041, their estate, that's going to have to report that income.
So, okay. So, Charles, does that answer your question?
Is there a step up in basis for the child on that? And
well, if
cost basis, if it's a land contract,
if the in the case of the land contract, the price is already set when they had the contract in it. So there is no step up in basis in a case like that, because the basis is determined by what that person paid or was supposed to pay to the parent.
Ah, okay.
If you haven't paid that much and your contract says you owe more, what you agreed to in the contract is your basis in it.
Okay, that makes sense. Charles, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Rita in Madison did not put a routing number on her tax return to enable direct deposit. How will she receive her tax refund?
Very good question, Rita. What the IRS has said is that if you do not provide them direct deposit information, they will send you a letter that requests it, and then you can provide it at that point, and then it will be direct deposited. if you don't respond to the letter, eventually you might get a check or maybe debit cards, you know, but there is a process. And remember, it's going to be a long process.
Yeah. You're going to be waiting perhaps a long time, Rita, but don't ignore the letter when it comes. That's, I guess, the good, make sure the letter is from the IRS when you get it, and then I would follow through and send that routing number. It'll help. Sarah in Shorewood, your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. So my question is, I have a college-age student who worked part-time part of last year with income, looks like $4,035, and they also received a monetary gift from a grandparent for Christmas this year, about $5,000. They are currently residing outside of the United States because they decided to go to college in Canada. And I'm kind of wondering what the income limits are for filing for them, or would they be penalized for not filing regardless because of their status of being out of the country?
Great question. If the person is out of the country and hasn't changed their citizenship, they're still U.S. citizens and required to file a tax return within the limits, no matter where they are. But as a college student, first of all, the $4,000, the $5,000 gift has no bearing on income tax. The $4,000 earned income, if that's all of their income, would not require a return to be filed because the standard deduction is $15,750, I believe. And they're well under that. If they had withholding, they'd probably want to file. But again, with that college student, you're getting into some other issues of, for instance, dependency. If that college student is temporarily outside of the United States to attend college and their home is still here and they intend to return, they're on holidays, et cetera, they may still be a dependent of the parent. And even though they don't have to file, their dependency has an impact on the parent's return.
So reducing the parent's return, perhaps.
Yes. The student would have a $500 other dependent exemption credit, like the child tax credit. Instead of the $2,200, they would qualify for a $500 credit.
Okay.
And again, and potentially education credits, depending on whether Canada... it has to be a U.S. college, but sometimes foreign colleges are sent through, you know, work abroad or whatever. So it would depend on those factors whether an education credit would be allowed.
Okay. Sarah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Beth in Madison. Your turn, Beth. Hi.
Hi. Both my husband and I are retired, and we get railroad retirement, both of us do. Every time we have someone do our taxes, they go, oh, railroad retirement. And why is it so complicated? And the person that does our taxes at one point said, well, every year it's supposed to be less and less that you can claim or something. And that doesn't sound right, because there was a time we had someone every year doing our returns, and she knew railroad taxes like the back of her hand. And she never made, you know, our retirement less, whatever it was. But she retired. And so I'm just curious, is there like somewhere we can go for special information? Or what is the big deal about retirement, railroad retirement?
Good question. Railroad retirement is two parts. Because railroad workers' retirement doesn't come under the Social Security system, unless that's changed in, you know, with new people, when you get railroad retirement and you open up the packet, there's three pieces to it usually. One is a different color than the other two. It's because railroad retirement has a Social Security factor in it. So it's part Social Security equivalent and part retirement. And that possibly could be what confuses people. Like any other retirement, the retirement portion is taxable, but sometimes there is a contribution, a post-tax contribution to the pension portion of the retirement, and that has to be taken care of. And it's reflected, there's, again, worksheets that help you keep track of all of that. But I think if someone has never dealt with it, they probably just don't know where to go with it. If you go to the IRS website, again, IRS has pension publications, and they do address railroad retirement in the pension publications. It's somewhere like 540, 590, one of those in that area is the retirement or pension publication. And you should be able to at least find the worksheets and maybe a better explanation that will, you know, satisfy you.
Yeah, yeah, that makes good sense. Beth, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. Mary Mellem, our guest tax professional from Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to a UW-Madison professor of bacteriology, Tim Paustain, about the hidden world of everyday bacteria, and then we'll talk to two local advocates of reducing plastic usage in their community. The community is doing a pretty good job on it, I presume. That's tomorrow. Right now, your taxes with Mary Mellem of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And let's take a call from John in Wisconsin Dells next. Hi, John.
How's it going, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I got a question for you. Does the IRS contact you directly?
What, you mean by phone call?
Yeah.
It depends on the situation. If you're working with an auditor, if you have called them, they could call you back. But just at random, they're not going to call you. They would correspond by mail if they want to audit you or have some question.
And I believe in talking with the folks from Consumer Protection that there are some scams out relating to supposedly the IRS calling people and demanding money right away and that sort of thing. So they're going to mail you a letter. I'm pretty sure of that, John. Let's turn to Clay in Loganville. Clay, hello.
Hi, great topic. Thanks for taking my call. My wife is collecting Social Security, but she works as a server. And on her W-2, it said in the tips, $7,000 exempt. I'm wondering if that means that $7,000 is going to reduce the amount of taxable income by that.
If on her W-2, the employer has said these are qualified tips of $7,000, you would report that $7,000 on the Schedule 1A, and it is a maximum of $25,000 on a joint return that you're able to take care of the tips. And yes, it is a direct it comes off the income, comes off of your AGI in the same way that the standard deduction comes off.
Okay. There you go.
Area of tax return.
There you go, Clay. Thank you for calling. Danica in Madison, your turn. Hi, Danica.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity. I was wondering where you would recommend investing money for our currently young children to use when they're adults towards anything they want, potentially non-educational.
Sounds like you're asking about the Trump accounts that are currently available. Is that possibly where you might be headed?
That's one option. I was also interested in putting money elsewhere.
Like
okay.
in stocks and bonds and that sort of thing, Danica?
Right.
No.
Right.
There are a lot of opportunities. You know, the uniform transfers to minor accounts are places that you can set up accounts for children, and they don't have access to the money without the guidance of the custodian until they get older. And those are the normal types of investments that you would have in that. Keeping in mind that if you set up a uniform transfer to minors account, any income that that account earns would be the child's income. And in the beginning, you know, unless you put a lot of money in it, it doesn't impact the child. They usually don't have to file. If it results in good investment income and it's over $1,350 a year, then that income could be subject to kiddie tax and taxed at the parent's rate. So that's kind of the after-tax investment. The 529 is the college savings plan. That doesn't give you the opportunity to use it for anything you want in theory, certainly for college. But even with the 529 plans, if the money is put away and it grows tax-free if you're using it for college, if you take it out and use it for something else, you pay taxes on the earnings and a penalty at that point. But with the 529 plans, there are opportunities, if they've been in there long enough, to put that money into a Roth IRA. Again, you'd pay taxes on the earnings, but once it's there, it's in a Roth IRA for that student or that person, the beneficiary. And then the last one is the new Trump accounts. And those are set up in the sense of being an IRA. You can contribute money to them for the child up to age 18. At 18, no more contributions can go into it. It becomes the child's money. If they take it out, it's like taking an IRA out, and you can have it. You pay tax on what isn't the after-tax basis. And if you use it for the right kinds of things, education, first-time home buyer, disability, the same things that early distributions are, it can avoid the penalty. So you have lots of opportunities to put things away.
Yeah. I was thinking about my daughter. We put a 529 when shortly after she was born, which did very well and covered her college and still money left over. And now that she's out working, she was thinking about rolling that money into a Roth. So can be done. We've done it. At least our family has. So lots of opportunities there, Danica. And thank you very much for calling. And Chuck in Prairie du Sac will go to you. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning, Larry and Mary. I have a question on payment of estimated tax. Last year, I was supposed to pay 4 payments of $900 each. Yeah, I know I got 2 in, and the rest got screwed up on whether I paid it or it came right out of my checking account. How can I find out how much money I really paid in for the estimated tax?
If you're talking about federal does not have a good way to see, for federal purposes, if you set up an ID.me account, and that's basically a setup, an account to be able to look at things at the IRS for yourself, you could get a transcript and see what they've received. On the state, if you're making Wisconsin estimates, Wisconsin does a much better job because they have an estimated tax lookup section where you can put in your Social Security number and another keyword like last year's income or how much your payment was, and you can see how much they've received for it. So it depends on who you're looking for finding that information, what route you take.
Yeah. What I did, I had that for one period, and I just went back to, since it was out of my checking account, I went back through my check just through to find the date that the IRS actually took the money. And I had that information in my own account. And that made it life a little easier for me when I was working on taxes, that's for sure. Mark,
you have it direct debited. There is that record. If you send them a check and you haven't recorded that check, it might be a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. And
to
Pete,
find out your side.
Yeah. Pete in La Crosse had emailed about that. He says he heard the IRS is no longer accepting checks for estimated payments throughout the year, and he wanted to know how he could do it electronically for those quarterly payments when he does not work with a bookkeeper, or can he just keep sending checks? It's pretty easy to do it online.
First of all, the IRS has not at this point stopped accepting checks to pay your tax bill or to pay your estimated tax payments. Clearly, it's going to come at some point. But right now, you can still write them a check. But if you are doing your tax electronically and you know what you want to pay in estimated tax payments, through software, you can set up those estimates in the times, at the appropriate times, to be withdrawn. Or you can go to Direct Pay, I believe is the name of the program, through the IRS, and just schedule your payments as direct debits from your accounts.
Yeah, it's pretty simple that way. Dave in Shorewood emailed to say he's been allowing his neighbor to use his EV car charger and is retired and drives in frequently, so about half his total electric bill is going to charge the neighbor's car. She's been reimbursing him at a rate per charge based on an average, and this year it was $700 and $800. If Venmo sends me a 1099-K next year detailing the payments, what can John include as his expenses for tax purposes?
Well, what John is doing by renting out his EV charger, he's in a Schedule C business.
Oh.
And so it's not rental of real estate, which would be a Schedule E business, but he would report the income and take any expenses that he would have with the EV charger. You know, if there is utility costs of plugging in that EV charger, he'd have to allocate those kinds of things to appropriately come up to what fits what he's charged.
Yeah, and he'd do that on a Schedule C.
On a Schedule C.
Yeah. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay. Great to have her with us, and she will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We will take a look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we will be back with Mary. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your taxes today on the show. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the business for more than 30 years, and she does a wonderful time, a wonderful job of answering questions. And you can join in. One open line, I think, at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. And let's go to Steve in Stoughton next. Hi, Steve.
Hey, and thanks, first of all, to Mary. She is a great asset for public radio. So I have an estate question regarding a house that my brother-in-law is the personal representative of the estate. This is in South Carolina. We live in Wisconsin, my wife and I. The house is in probate, and fairly soon it has it's been on the market. It's no longer on the market. We don't think it's going to get sold before probate ends in March. The next step for my brother-in-law as the personal representative is to file a deed of distribution with my wife's name and his name on the deed so that the house would then be titled in their names. We do not want to enter into that relationship for lots of reasons. I won't go into right now, but for lots of reasons, we do not want to enter into that relationship. And I'm wondering what the tax implications are for us by not, you know, participating.
Question. First of all, let me go to the other side and tell you the tax implications if you do enter into this issue. I don't know when the death was that resulted in the inheritance of the house, but at that date, the value of that house is established. That value compared with the sale price, the difference between those two is any gain that you would have. And you would also take into consideration the closing costs, and that gain would be shrunk because the closing costs would reduce that gain. So entering into that would basically end up with no tax. Now, I understand you may have other reasons why you don't want to do that, but just having been distributing that property would be fine there. If you give up that property, as part of probate, you could relinquish your right, or your wife could relinquish her right to the estate, and that has no tax consequences. It would just be economically, if she gives up her right to the estate, the other person gets it all and she gets nothing. And the other way, I don't know how probate is in South Carolina, but generally if the property were sold inside the estate, and again, I don't know the wording of the will and I'm not a lawyer to know all of that, but if it had been sold inside the estate, the same tax consequences that I mentioned would have been applied, and it would be just the money left over would be distributed, and there would be no tax consequences if there's no tax consequences on the sale of the house. So I think the issue is not so much a tax issue, but maybe a legal issue, how to navigate settling the estate.
Yeah. Steve, does that help?
Yes, thank you. That's extremely helpful. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate the call. And Mark in New Lisbon, we turn to you. Hi, Mark.
Yes, sir. Last year, all my capital gains were from mutual fund distributions, so I did not fill out the capital gains form for 8995. But the IRS wrote back and said I had to do that, the capital gains form. Now, what do I do this year? Because the way I read it, if it's all from the capital gains from mutual funds distribution, you just put that on your 1040.
Okay. I'm thinking maybe the IRS is seeing something different. First of all, if the capital gain distributions you're talking about come on a 1099 DIV in the box that's there, there is a box on the capital gain line that says no 1099 or no 89 49 needed, you check that box and enter the capital gains in there. If either you didn't check that box, so they're asking for the form, or they're seeing something in addition to the DIV capital gain distributions.
Okay. Mark, do you understand that?
Yeah, I understand that, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Jerry in Kokana. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, and thank you, Mary and Larry. Quick question. Self-employed, is there an easy way to keep track of small purchases like pens and paper clips and that, or do you just keep your receipts and just put them in office expenses category or something like that?
That's the best way to do that, is to keep your receipts. I don't know of any other way. There's no per diem amount or, you know, set amount that you can say, oh, I have office expenses, my normal is this, and just use that number. You have to have the actual receipts.
All right, Jerry, thank you very much for calling. And you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Get you on pretty quickly. Open lines. Renee emailed to say she has a small business with no employees. Is Renee able to hire her son without putting him on an official payroll? She read on the IRS website that it is legal up to a certain amount, around $12,000 per year.
I'm not sure the interpretation of that last statement, but yes, family employment is a normal thing. It's a good savings technique for people. But if you're hiring your child and you are a Schedule C business, not a corporation or a partnership, then yes, you can hire that child. You need to keep payroll records of what you pay that child. You need to do a W-2, but there are special rules where FICA tax and FUTA tax are not due on that income if they're under 18 for FICA and 21 for FUTA. So you avoid some of the payroll taxes that you would have hiring other people, but they still need a W-2 to show that income, and you need to make sure that you have records of their employment. There have been court cases where people have said they hired their children, didn't do the appropriate bookkeeping, and the audits would throw those things out because they didn't do the proper things. So if you're going to do it, it's legitimate. The $12,000 figure, what I have a feeling that someone is saying is, if you pay your child under the standard deduction amount, which is the $15,750, then they don't have any income consequences. So I think that's probably what that $12,000 that was said is kind of alluding to.
Yeah, I think you're right. Jeannie in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm going to file my income taxes online for the first time for 2025. Is it simply a matter of going to the IRS and looking at forms? And I guess my question is, how do I obtain a PIN for VID purposes online?
If you need an ID PIN, you have to go to the IRS website, click in IP PIN, and do the proper paperwork that goes for it. If you're going to the IRS website to file online, you have to go through one of their free file programs. It isn't just filling out the online forms that you can get. You're going to do it electronically. So you would be going through some type of software that either is through the IRS website, through the state website, something like that.
All right. There you go, Jeannie. Good luck, and thank you. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my wife and I have a cabin up in northern Wisconsin. We've had it for 26 years. It's been strictly personal use. Recently, we decided that we're getting older. We don't use it very much. We were going to sell it, but the capital gains is so restrictive on that. I mean, we'd spend a lot of money on that. So we're thinking about renting it a few times a year, and then after a couple of years doing a 1031 exchange on the property for something closer to home. My question is, if we start renting this property now after we've owned it for 26 years, how do we do depreciation on that?
If you are going to rent a property that you have previously owned, your depreciable basis is the lesser of fair market value or your cost in the property. So generally, it's going to be in this market, it's going to be your cost in the property. So you're going to have to come up with, what did I pay for it? Did I make substantial improvements to add that to it? And do it on the depreciation that way. Keep in mind, if you are using this property and renting it, that if it's a vacation rental, that you have used the property more than 14 days for yourself, there's allocations with that. And it concerns me a little bit when you said the like-kind exchange, because if you cannot do a like-kind exchange with personal property, you can do like-kind exchange with rental property, but you're exchanging it for another piece of business or investment property. So when you said something closer to home, if you're exchanging it and you intend to use it as a rental closer to, I mean, as a property that you're going to use personally, you're going to run into some tax consequences with that. So make sure you get some good advice before you do that. When you have a vacation rental, you pick up the income, you can take your expenses allocated to that part, but only up to the income that you've picked up. You cannot claim a loss on a vacation rental. Rental, yes, but not a vacation.
Mike, there you go. Things to think about for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Dave in Superior, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Yes. We bought a stock in a company here, a Minnesota Power Elite company, about 35 years ago. And we enrolled in the DRIP program, and that company was taken over entirely here this last December. And so we've got little tiny stock purchases every quarter since then. And I have records of all of it, but is there a way of averaging? We've not bought any additional stock or sold any stock out of this program. They're all intact. Is there any way to do it just by totaling up the purchases and the final sale?
First of all, whatever you originally paid for it, plus all of, and I think it cut out, but I think you meant reinvest the dividends. Each of those investments of the dividends would be additional basis. And that would be your total stock ownership in it. And when you said taken over, are you being forced to sell it as a result of this takeover? So whatever you sell it for, the complete package, compare whatever that sales price compared to all of your basis that's added together would be your gain. Now, some of it might be short term. So if you reinvested dividends within the last year, 12 months prior to the sale date, those would be considered short term, and you should have the cost basis for those few reinvested dividends compared to that amount that you would get for that number of shares as short-term. The rest would all be long-term. So you would be allocating it all together, like, you know, selling 100 shares and whatever cost basis went into those 100 shares, that would be it. Each share doesn't get reported separately.
Dave, does that make sense?
Separately. Yes, each individual quarterly purchase doesn't have to be reported separately, except for the ones that are short-term.
Long-term, exactly.
Okay. All right. That makes life a lot easier for you, Dave. I'm pretty sure of that. Thank you very much for calling. Darren emailed to ask when the no tax on overtime goes into effect. Is it for the entire 2025 tax year or just when it was passed last year and going forward?
That's a great question. It does encompass the entire year. So if you look at your last pay, if the employer tells you what the qualified overtime is, some of them are reporting it in box 14 of the W-2. And again, with the overtime, it's just the premium portion of it, the extra half, one and a half, you know, times. It's just the half that is the what is not taxable. But if you don't have it, if the employer hasn't directly reported it to you, then go to the W-2 and take a look at the W-2. If it reports your total overtime for the year, take that number. If you get time and a half, not double time, but if you get time and a half, take that number, divide it by 3, and that's your adjustment.
That's the adjustment. Okay. Let's see. Kyle in Winnicott emailed to say he received $350 of qualified tips and forgot to add the deduction to his return. He used the standard deduction. Is it worth him filing an amendment to add this? Kyle's already filed and paid. How much would it cost him to have it sorted out by a professional?
Well, if it's $350 of tips that he has, he would multiply that 350 times his tax rate, and that would tell him whether it's worthwhile or not. So if I did 350 and I'm in the 12% tax bracket, it's going to make me about $40 worth of difference by amending the tax return. And so it would be up to him to decide whether that's worthwhile or not.
Yeah, for $40, I don't know. Gina in Pewaukee emailed to ask, how does the no tax on overtime work and how much will it increase in return in general? Also, is Gina correct in understanding that the tax law changes for tips and overtime? The senior deduction increase standard deduction and SALT cap are not permanent and will expire in a few years.
All four of the deductions that she mentioned have an expiration date. They, I believe, are 4 years. I believe the SALT is 5 years. But the tips, the overtime, and the senior for sure are 4 years. The car loan interest is in that category as well, and I believe SALT is 5 years. As far as, again, how much benefit they do to you, overtime is the premium portion. So if you're making $30 an hour and overtime is $45, it's the 15 times the number of hours that are qualified hours that will reduce your income. Whatever that number is times your tax rate is the benefit that it's saving you. It is a deduction in the same area that the standard deduction or itemized deductions come. It is a below-the-line deduction. It doesn't affect anything that is affected by AGI. TIPS is a dollar-for-dollar deduction in exactly the same area. Again, they're qualified tips and qualified overtime, so it may not necessarily be everything you received. Although this year being the transitional year, people may be benefiting from more than they're going to get when the employer specifically has to calculate it next year.
Okay. Patricia in Beloit called, couldn't stay with us. She's owed a tax refund of more than $700, but despite talking with an IRS representative on the phone, the refund is not sent to her, and she doesn't understand why. Is this problem unusual?
Well, it, you know, there can be a lot of reasons why that refund is not sent to her. And there have been, the IRS is behind in solving problems. It could be that it's caught up on somebody's desk and it's legitimate. It could be that they're questioning whether that fund belongs to her or whether it's legitimate. I would either suggest that she keep calling the IRS and asking for questions, you know, asking for answers. She should have gotten communication with them and, you know, asking where the refund is or if they want information. Otherwise, talk to a tax professional and, you know, see what the bottom line issue is.
And Sonia emailed to ask what to do if your employer doesn't provide the dollar amount paid out for overtime, leaving it to the employees to calculate that amount.
There have to be records. You can't just come up with it out of the, pulling it out of the hat. If the employer does payroll report, you know, gives you a check stub, somewhere there is a record of that overtime. And you either have to have the pay stubs if they are not doing it or the final pay stub that has effectively on there. If your employer pays you in cash and doesn't give you any record of that, you're in trouble.
Okay. Well, on that happy note, Mary, as always, it is such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much. And we look forward to another visit from you. Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome, Larry.
Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Her business, Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Been doing it a long time, as you can tell by the range of answers and the quality of the answers she provides. It's really great. Coming up next, animal behaviorist Patricia McConnell returns to talk about her first novel. It's a mystery, a murder mystery, and it's called A Way to Me. I'm Larry Mueller. Wisconsin, there's an animal behaviorist who raises sheep and enters her border collie in sheepdog competition. And that pretty much, I think it describes Patricia McConnell a bit, but also describes the main character in her first novel, a murder mystery. It's titled A Way to Me. And I really enjoyed reading it. A Way to Me is the title. Patricia McConnell, the author, a certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker, author of several books on dog training and behavior issues with dogs. It's great to have her here to talk about her first novel, A Way to Me. And if you have questions or comments as we move along, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk at WPR.org. Patricia, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Under different circumstances.
Yes, no kidding.
A novel. You've written so many, best-selling books about dog behavior. Here you've got a novel. Was it harder, easier? What was it like writing a novel?
It was wonderful and horrible. But overall, I loved it. I started it literally just for fun. It was like I was over 70. I was retiring from all these different things that I've been doing. But I love to read, and I love beautiful writing, and I aspire to be a really good writer. So I just started playing at it. I had the scene in my head. It's the first chapter. Somebody's killed at a sheepdog trial.
4.5 pages in.
Yeah. I don't waste any time. And I just sort of started, like I said, it was doing it for fun. And then I got absolutely obsessed with learning the craft of writing fiction. It is, here's what I've learned to say. Writing bad fiction. I used to say writing bad fiction is easy and writing good fiction is hard. Now I say writing bad fiction is hard, but writing good fiction is even harder. But I love learning how to write better. And I have a long way to go, first thing I will say, but I love doing it.
Well, I certainly really enjoyed your book, A Way to Me. And A Way to Me, by the way, would you explain the title there?
Yeah, the title has two meanings, which is part of the fun of writing. So A Way to Me is a cue given to a sheepdog to go counterclockwise around the sheep. But it's also a metaphor for Maddie. Maddie McGowan is the protagonist. Basically, this is a story about a woman who risks her life to save a dog. I mean, really, that's the elevator sense, right? So Maddie McGowan, where start well, over? What was your question again?
Well, no, I'm really you're right on the right track, because I was going to ask you to kind of give us an outline for those. Obviously, the book is just coming out, so people haven't had a chance to read it.
Yeah, it comes out next week on the 24th. I'll be speaking at Arcadia Bookstore or across the street. On the 24th, and Mystery to Me in Madison on March 5th. Please come. It's so fun to see people. So, so Maddie McGowan, Write What You Know, right? I did consciously do that because I thought, I don't know how to write fiction. I'm happy to say I know nothing about murder and law enforcement related to murder. So Maddie McGowan is living sort of her best life after, quote, what happened in New Mexico that she doesn't like to talk about. She has sheep. She competes in sheepdog trials. She's a behaviorist. She really stays to herself. So the other metaphor for A Way to Me is that Maddie sort of pushes people away. She has two good friends, but otherwise she pushes people away. But she really does want another kind of relationship that she doesn't admit to herself. And that becomes clear as the novel moves on.
It does indeed. And one of her best friends is the one who gets George.
Yeah, George is her mentor, her friend, her sheepdog training mentor. She becomes friends when she buys this little puppy named Jack from him. He is inexplicably shot at a sheepdog trial. And she's recovering from trying, right? Recovering from the shock of losing this dear friend of hers. And she ends up fostering a dog from a shelter. By the way, call out to animal shelters and rescue groups everywhere. The dog is doing better. She's doing better. Things are starting to really sort of heal up, getting back to her regular life. And one day she goes home and she finds that one of her dogs is gone. Just gone. And by the way, parenthetically, I should say here, Larry, no dog dies in the making of this novel. Because otherwise no dog lover would read it. My editor was like, Tricia, you're ruining the plot. I was like, no, I'm keeping the dog lovers from not reading it.
Well, and that dog, Cisco, if I'm remembering right, is a pretty cool dog.
Cisco is a very cool dog. He's a foster. Jack is a very cool dog. Jack is her border collie, who manages her sheep and competes with sheepdog trials. Bo Peep is her sheep guarding dog, a Great Pyrenees. And Clementine is the old terrier who is mistaken for a pillow often because she's a real old girl and she sleeps a lot.
Well, the number of dogs. I mean, you've got a couple of best friends in there, but really, your dogs are your best friends.
Yeah, they are definitely Maddie's best friends. But I have to admit that I have a lot of great human friends, and I have a wonderful husband. And without question, they are my best friends. But dogs are part of my family, and I describe myself as an author, an animal behaviorist, and someone who is stupid in love with dogs. And I adore them. Dogs and people are my favorite species, although people sometimes make it a little more challenging.
Well, you know, one of the things I kind of enjoyed about the book, I did enjoy about the book, is there are reflections that Maddie goes through on her experiences in her work as somebody who works with dogs and always troubled. You know, I mean, you're there. Maddie's there working with those dogs because there are real problems associated with the dogs, and maybe they're going to have to get put down or something like that. And Maddie takes that really personally.
Yeah, you know, I love that you brought that up, Larry. I've done, I think, 18 podcasts so far to promo the book, and most of the people who listen are dog lovers or a lot of dog professionals. And one of the things I've heard over and over again in the last month is how gratified people who are trainers and behaviorists and vet behaviorists are about reading what their life is really like, because many of us feel that people seem to think, based on what they say, that we spend our days sort of running through fields of daisies with golden retriever puppies. Yeah. And it's actually a really hard, hard job. And they have been so happy to see, like, this is, somebody can read what my life is like. You know, they feel seen, right? And so one of the things I learned about fiction when I was learning about writing it was that a lot of people, part of what they like about fiction is that it opens it up to a world that they don't know. And I never thought about that, but it's, you know, it's true with me. And so one of the fun things, and it was never my intent, but one of the fun things to me about this novel is that people will get to see what it's like to be at a sheepdog trial. People will get to see what it's like to be an animal behaviorist, you know. All of the cases that Maddie saw are some kind of variation on cases I've seen, without question.
And actually, you know, thinking about all the years we worked together, you were imparting not only those feelings, but also a pretty good information to people who might say, that's what my dog.
Yeah. And I didn't, again, you know, it wasn't my intent. My intent was to write a good story. You know, to write a hero's journey story about sort of every person who gets faced with this huge challenge and has to deal with it. But you know, the fact of the matter is that Maddie is dealing with just the same kind of things that every animal behaviorist and top trainer actually deals with. And so it wasn't hard for me to write about those cases. That was sort of the easy part. The hard part for me, Larry, was plotting a plot, you know? Yeah. All the books I've written, I often start with a short story, like a page and a half of a scene.
Yeah.
But then putting that all together in a narrative that is a page turner, you know, that was really challenging for me and really fun to learn how to do it.
Patricia McConnell, our guest today, she is the author, this is her first novel, maybe not her last. She's probably... I'll get into that with her in a bit. The current novel is titled Away to Me. Questions for Patricia? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today on WPR News. Larry Mehler here. We are talking with Patricia McConnell about her novel, A Way to Me. And again, questions for her. Give a call the number, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I was doing a kind of a count in my head of the number of dogs. There are a half a dozen dogs that play a role in this. One, two, three, four, five, wrote them down, six of them.
There are dogs. One of my hopes is that people who are not necessarily dog crazy will still love reading this book because it's hopefully because I wanted to write a really good page turning, keep you up at night mystery novel. And I've talked to a couple of people who are not, who, you know, they might like dogs, right? But they're not crazy like I am. And they said, it was really good. So my hope is it expands outside the dog world. But the fact of the matter is, it's really, there's a lot of dogs in this book.
Lots of dogs. And a couple of them relate. I know there's a ranger that you're, a dog that you're working with, a six-year-old Milwaukee
canine,
afraid, who happens to be afraid of thunder, which would be awful for a dog in that situation.
That's right. And that is such a common problem here in the Midwest. I mean, we do live in Thunder Alley, and it is so hard on dogs. They basically think God is growling at them. I had so many clients. I had, I think, three clients at least in the 25 or so years whose dogs went through upper story windows, right? Landed on the pavement. So, so it's not an uncommon, I mean, that's uncommon, but fear of thunder is a real serious problem. I've had two dogs I had to work it through with them.
And there are dogs in there that, the whole business about police dog training I thought was interesting too, for drugs and that sort of thing.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up. Because you said something about my first book. So here's the fantasy, Larry. The fantasy, the hope, the dream is that this is a trilogy.
Ah.
And there's the first one is A Way to Me. Again, go counterclockwise around the sheep. The second one is Come By, which means go clockwise around the sheep. It is also, by the way, another metaphor for Maddie, who is come by. Come. By in relation to the men in her life.
Yeah.
And then the third one is That'll Do, which in sheepdog parlance means come back to me now, dog. Your work here is done.
Oh, my goodness. And so those are already rolling around in your head?
I've started the second one. I don't have time to work on it very much right now because of, this book coming out. But I'm hungry to keep writing on it. I take notes almost every single day about, this could happen and, that could happen. And,
that last chapter, I thought, I can see where this is there.
Definitely
some more coming down the road. And we should, before I even forget about it, let's go through. I know you're going to be speaking around Wisconsin pretty darn quickly. You sort of mentioned in passing at the beginning, but, people everywhere here are going to want to know where you are.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Larry. Yeah, I am speaking first. Well, first of all, the quick version is you can just go to my website, patriciamcconnell.com, go to events, and you get the whole speaking speaking schedule. But I'm speaking next week, Tuesday the 24th, through Arcadia Bookstore. You can just go to their website and get yourself on there. March 5th, I'm speaking in Madison at Mystery to Me. And in between those times, I'm speaking in Milwaukee, Lake Geneva, Stevens Point, and Green Bay. And then, in a week later, I'm going to Texas. So all of your Texas listeners, I'll be in San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas.
Oh my goodness. Is it, based on your successes with your first books, which were not novels, I mean, did that help in terms of getting people to...
Getting published, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes and no. One of the things I've learned about fiction is that it is so hard to get published. My agent said, like, it's a triumph to get published by anybody. And there's just a fire hose of books coming out every hour, not every day, but every hour of fiction. Everybody wants to write fiction. So it helped. It definitely helped that I have a following, you know, Facebook and Instagram. Definitely helped that I've had, you know, other, by the way, Other End of the Leash, which was in, I think, I always forget, 12 or 13 languages. It's just going to be published in Ukraine, which just makes me so happy.
Oh, my goodness.
I can just add a little bit of light to that country, you know, going through so much. But, yeah, it was it's not easy to get published. And so Kensington took a chance on me, and I'm very grateful to them. They're so we'll see what happens.
Well, I think the plot really turns on how many police dogs are trained to sniff out drugs.
There is certainly a component, and the reason I mentioned the trilogy is that in the next book that I mentioned, the dog that Maddie brings home to help her, to help the dog, is either going to be a wildlife detection dog or a search and rescue human remains detection dog. So one of the fun things for me is that I'm learning a lot. That's the one aspect of canine behavior I've known the least about. So I went to a seminar in Virginia. I spent the weekend with people who were training search and rescue dogs, for example. So I'm just learning a ton about dogs using their noses. And it's really fun. It's just really fun for me. And I think really interesting to the general public. It's like, how does this work?
Michael sent an email to ask, are wolves afraid of thunder? If not, how did dogs become fearful of thunder?
That is a great question. And I don't know. We need to get some of the experts. We need to get Adrian out here on the radio and ask him. It might be that they are. But I would guess less commonly. You know, we have dogs are so much like wolves, but they're so different than wolves in so many ways. And I think part of the fact, maybe just speculating, that dogs are so often afraid of thunder when God is growling, but also they don't have the agency that wolves have. You know, village dogs. They want to run away, they can run away, right? And our dogs can't. I mean, they're trapped in a house or they're trapped in a car. They can't act on their fears very well. So they'll come to us and whine and cry and, you know, scratch at the door. So I think that, you know, that makes things scarier when you don't have more control. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised if far fewer wolves are afraid of thunder. But that is a great question.
Seems to me, just as an aside, I mean, when you're growing up as a wolf, you're around mom and dad and everybody else, and if they're not scared.
Yeah, yeah. And dogs don't have that. So many dogs live with humans, right? Like, as you say, Larry, they live with a different species. So that's a really good point. That might be part of it.
Liz emailed to say she has all of your training books. Ages ago, Liz went to one of your seminars and took a dog in for a behavior assessment. She teaches entry-level agility, and your techniques have helped her to train the people and their dogs.
Well, that is what it is. You know, ask every trainer and behaviorist. I will tell you the most common thing that we say is that it is so much easier to train the dog than the people. I actually learned when I was doing one-on-one consults, if I started just training the dog, that was like, oh, whoops, Trisha's really tired. You need to get your act together, right? Take some deep breaths because you're supposed to be training the people, not the dog.
And I want to go back to that whole part that you were so eloquently talking about, which was the burden of the person who's doing the training, like Maddie here. I thought that was so well written.
Oh, thank you. And it's true. I mean, I think most people in helping professions take on a certain amount of burdens. And you know, we have to be really careful. All of us have to be really careful to not take on too much, because then you get burnt out. You know, nobody knows this better than a nurse, for example, you know, is to be compassionate, to be sympathetic, but to take on the burden. Maddie hasn't quite learned that yet. Maddie is obsessed with solving the mystery. She's absolutely obsessed with finding this dog. And she can't give it up. She absolutely can't give it up. She has issues, as many of us do, right? Yeah. She has a past. And one of the things that happened to her is that she couldn't save George, you know, her mentor who was killed in the first chapter. She couldn't save him, and she feels horrible about that. And here she's trying to, you know, trying to always sort of save dogs, and she definitely compromises her lifestyle in order to try and help dogs.
So, and we kind of have two things here, and the two stories going on, or maybe three, but we've got George's murder. Mm-hmm. So that we need to, she's worried about that and who did it and solving it. And by the way, there are several possibilities.
Yes, of course. Of course.
In the book. But then the other side story, but they come together, is the dog that gets taken.
The missing dog, right? Finding the missing dog. And then there's a little romance scattered in there.
Oh, yeah.
There's just a little bit of that.
And some, and I was trying to think of, is it Chris?
Chris.
The Humane Society volunteer. So the Humane Society gets some words in there as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that happened, and I've read about this with other authors, but it's different to experience it than it is to read about it. You get so fond of your characters.
Yeah.
You know, at first Maddie was like, I knew her demographic. She was, you know, mid-40s, and she left New Mexico with a bad, you know, blah, blah. But as I was writing, they're like a photograph in a dark room, and they just start getting clearer and stronger. And that I could, Maddie is sitting right beside me. I can picture her. I can feel her. I understand her. So, you know, I'm fond of her. I don't know. And Chris and Maddie's best friend, Dorothy, who is this, as I say in the book, who face of an actress and mouth of a sailor.
Yeah.
Based on two of my friends, by the way. I combined two of them together.
Have you told your friends that?
Yes. Actually, I have.
Well, the one said, well, I'm the mouth of a sailor, but
and
not
she
the
knows.
Pretty one.
Oh, I haven't put it that way. I have to be careful. Uh-oh, now I'm in trouble. She's actually gorgeous. They're both gorgeous.
Oh, man. So it's a lot of fun. The book is fun. And, you know, it's tough. And things about Maddie's, they sort of appear slowly over the course of the book, and it's in the end, near the end, we find out the worst.
What happened in New Mexico, and that's, you know, so many books are like that, is like you just, you know, build up to some big part of what is motivating Maddie to behave the way she behaves.
And then the surprise of who really did the murder comes out at the end.
So did you know? Huh? Did you?
I didn't, really.
Good. That's music to my ears, your producer, Joel. He just said, I didn't know who it was going to be either. It's like, yes, good.
I
did my job.
I was surprised. and you've written a fun, interesting and novel here, and I hope it sells a million copies.
Oh, thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Patricia. Patricia McConnell's book, A Way to Me, and go to her website. And find out more about each of the appearances she's going to be making here in Wisconsin. She's got a bunch coming up in the next month or so, and one even next week. So do that. And thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.